Welcome to Changemakers. I'm Edie Lush. I am thrilled to be joining the Changemakers family of presenters for a brand new series. We're going to be focusing on some of the most pressing global issues of our time. Today, I'll be speaking to three incredible campaigners and activists about refugees, their stories, experiences, and contributions to the UK. Two of them are refugees themselves. Taban Shoresh is founder and CEO of The Lotus Flower. It's a charity helping women and girls overcome trauma. Lord Alfred Dubs is a Labour peer and tireless campaigner for the rights of refugees. He arrived to the UK on the Kinder transport in 1939. And I'm joined first by Amos Schoenfield. He's the founder of Our Second Home. It's a youth movement that supports young refugees to settle and succeed in their new home. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Edie?
Good. Nice to see you.
And you.
So tell me, first of all, what's the most important thing to think about when we think about refugees and asylum seekers?
I think that we've got the whole story wrong when it comes to people who are coming here to seek asylum, coming here to seek sanctuary. We imagine these people who are here as a drain, here as a burden, that we're doing them a favor. We're actually gaining so much from people who are coming here, you know, because of hardship, because of fleeing persecution, war, and violence. But when you have someone who's come to the UK, often on their own, often as a teenager, often through incredible hardship, these are people who have immense creativity, determination, ingenuity, independence. There's so many opportunities that we're on the cusp of gaining through the people who are arriving here today, and that we can see through generations before that we have gained from their predecessors, at least in their legal status and their route.
To better understand what refugees are contributing to the UK, let's look at the stories of those who fled persecution and found new beginnings here. We'll start with Taban Shoresh. She's a women's rights activist and founder of non-profit organization, The Lotus Flower. Taban was awarded an OBE by the UK government in 2023 for her services to refugees and displaced conflict survivors. I asked her how she escaped Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq.
So I'm Kurdish and I fled Iraq, Kurdistan, in the 1980s because my dad was a poet, a political activist, and a Peshmerga, so a freedom fighter. So we were persecuted by Saddam Hussein. I was in prison at the age of four. We were destined to be buried alive and had a very, very lucky escape. I remember the day we were taken to prison. I remember what it felt like to be in prison. I remember all the adults screaming, wailing, begging them not to kill us, begging the soldiers not to kill us. The desperation in people's eyes. I remember as a child, especially within that context, when adults are going through things like this, you kind of dim your childness. You know not to cry because the adults are going through something. You know not to ask for anything. You know not to say anything. So instantly, you become an adult overnight, but you're still a child. And that, I think, is a basic right that's taken away from children, and no child should have to experience that. So we experienced all of that, but then my father was poisoned by Saddam Hussein. He'd hired a husband and wife to poison a group of men. And we ended up in the UK because Amnesty International flew us to the UK for medical treatment for him. And
that is a lucky
time
escape.
It was a very, very lucky escape on so many different areas. I mean, this was during the Iran and Iraq war as well. So we were being persecuted as Kurds by Saddam Hussein. But then within the context of the Iran and Iraq war, which was quite violent, you know, I do remember bombs every day being dropped. And so we were very, very lucky to come to the UK for safety. And the context that we arrived in is very, very different to the environment now.
Let's step back further to World War II. As a child, Alfred Dubs was brought to safety on the Kinder transport. He's now Lord Alfred Dubs, a Labour peer and campaigner for refugees.
I was 6 years old. The Germans occupied Prague in March 1939. My father was Jewish. He left immediately. my mother was refused permission to leave, and she got me on a kinder transport. But before that, we had German soldiers everywhere. We had to tear a picture of President Benesch out of our school books and stick in a picture of Hitler, all that sort of thing. And then she put me on the train, not knowing whether she'd ever see me again. And there were several, perhaps 100 to 150 of us on that train. And we left Prague, parents anxious on the platform, not knowing whether they'd see their children again. And off the train went. And it took 2 days. We got to the Dutch border, and the older ones cheered because we're out of reach of the Nazis. I just was looking for windmills and wooden shoes or whatever else I knew about Holland. Anyway, it was dark. And we got on the boat and then to Harwich and the Hook of Holland and Harwich and then the train to Liverpool Street. So in one sense, I was lucky. I was lucky that my father was there. And in another sense, although my mother was refused permission to leave, somehow or other, she did escape. And she got to London the day before the war started.
Do you know how? Do you know how she made it out?
Well, you see, when she was refused permission to leave first time, she went to, it was a Gestapo place, and they said permission, exit permit refused, and they threw her down the stairs. And she landed in a heap at the bottom of the stairs. And before she could work out what was broken, if anything, she realized they'd thrown her passport after her. And somehow or other, she managed to get an exit permit. I never learned how, but she managed to do it. And she arrived in London. And if she'd arrived the day later, it wouldn't have been possible because the war started. She arrived in London on the 31st of August, and the war started on September the 1st.
Amos also has a personal connection to the kinder transport through his grandfather's efforts during the Holocaust.
My grandfather, who is Rabbi Dr. Solomon Schonfeld, was involved in the kinder transport. So that was the movement in the Second World War during the Holocaust to bring children over to the UK. And before, during, and after the Holocaust, my grandfather helped bring over 3,000 people to the UK. Many of them were children. Many were not. And the things that he was doing in order to achieve that was sort of driven by immense determination and what would probably be called in Yiddish chutzpah, sort of a huge amount of sort of gumption and...
So I prefer chutzpah to resilience as a word. Let me just go on the record for saying that.
Chutzpah over resilience, I think, is a great way of thinking about it. Some of my favorite stories is he would, in effect, make up professions to the Home Office to say, we need to bring over these key Jewish community professionals. So he was talking about rabbis as well, but he made up, you know, people who tie the knots on a Jewish prayer shawl, the tzitzit, as they're called. That's not a thing that requires skill beyond simply knowing how to do it, but he told them, we need these 30 people because they're the ones who are excellent at this. And through that, he saved 30 lives. He was traveling in and out of Europe both before, very close to the start of the Second World War, and also following the Holocaust and Second World War. And he once brought over a boatload of young people. And as they sort of ported into Portsmouth, I think it was, he told all the children to run around. He told them in Yiddish, run around, run around. And as the border official came on, he couldn't count the young people that were on the boat.
Right.
And he said, Dr. Schonfeld, please, can you stop them? You know, we need to do this. And he said, you know, kids will be kids. I can't do it. You know, I can't help you. And through that, he brought over way more people than he was allowed to. And he did that because he was saving lives.
Now, as the founder of Our Second Home, Amos helps young refugees find community in the UK and helps them build skills through residential programs and leadership training.
So Our Second Home, we're the UK's youth movement for refugees and asylum seekers. The idea of a youth movement, we can get into more perhaps later. But we see young people, in our case, 14 to 18 years old, arriving in the UK, often on their own, often without that support system that, you know, I relied on as someone born and raised here. You may have relied on both, you know, throughout your journey. And we are able to support them through residential trips, going away, having a break sometimes, through leadership training where we take the young people who've been on our trips and give them the skills and the experiences to become leaders, and also through youth clubs, through online English and maths classes, and through advocacy and support and networking, the kinds of things that, you know, we need to support them. What that means is that we're creating a new generation of refugee leaders. We are creating a resilient community that lets those leaders and the people who they're supporting to learn, fail, succeed, stand up, fall down, rely on each other. And we're helping the young people gain confidence, gain English, feel like they are able to both embrace what makes them different and what makes them the same as everyone around them. Refugee flows, you know, that to use that kind of abstract term, I guess, tend to skew young because the people who are most able to travel often are younger. They are not always as young as the ones we work with, you know, still teenagers, but many are, you know, in their teens and 20s. We often find these are people who might have been sent away by their families because they only have the resources to send, you know, one person to try and seek safety, to try and then build a life whilst everyone else hopefully stays safe where they are. We often find that people are simply just following the trail of a family member and needing that support, choosing, you know, fight all the way to the UK through everything because they know that the UK is where someone else has succeeded or where they have family links or language links. So we tend to see that, you know, we're seeing a pretty broad range of people who fit within that the average idea of who might be seeking asylum in the UK.
Amos shared the story of one of the refugees he's worked with who had a harrowing journey to the United Kingdom.
So there's one of a young person who was part of one of our early cohorts of leaders who came from East Africa, ending up finally in Italy after having paid off traffickers and smugglers and traveling through Europe I think he told me that he spent his time on trains hiding in the toilet and basically acting like the toilet was out of order. So that no one would come and check on him, ending up deciding almost on a whim, I think, he was choosing between various places that he thought might be safe and had heard from a friend of a friend that London was better, which is that reputation that, you know, we all talk about, how great Britain is. And he'd heard it. And he ended up jumping into the back of a bus, sort of a passenger bus in Calais, finding a compartment that would be safe for him and appearing in London at the end of his journey. And through meeting lots of organizations that would be able to support him as a child asylum seeker, he ended up coming on our program, is a wonderful, sensitive person. And what he told us is that his aspiration was to be a doctor. You know, he wanted to help people. He wanted to contribute also not only to the UK, but also to his family, be able to help his siblings who hadn't made it over, and ended up, you know, within 2 years of arriving in the UK, of needing to catch up with his entire education system, the thing that took me, you know, 14 years to get through, ended up being able to get to that end stage of being able to start applying for medicine in the UK. He is now training to be a doctor. That journey is not straightforward and requires luck and requires determination. And it requires those sort of catalysts, people and circumstances that can help propel you forward. With people like him, there are many people who touch his life and who support him going forward. And we were one of those catalysts. You know, we helped the application. But it's just one story among many that show what is possible.
Extraordinary. What an amazing story. So I think it's important to think about the language that we talk about refugees with. And so often the language is, as you mentioned at the start, this idea that they're a drain, they're a pull on services, rather than being an addition, that something that the economy needs, that we need as human beings to have different cultures, different kinds of lives around us. Talk a little bit about how language matters and how that could help shift the debate.
We typically have heard the government referring to people seeking asylum as illegal immigrants. And the label of illegal has gone now. They get called now irregular migrants, which has its own challenges, which we can talk about. But calling someone an illegal immigrant implies both that what they've done is illegal and it's not illegal. It's not illegal to seek asylum. It's in, you know, we've signed up to the Refugee Convention that says it's legal. And it also implies that person and everything about them is illegal. And people can't be illegal. And we have to start rethinking that. We have to start approaching things differently. Now, having the idea of regular and irregular migration implies that it's weird to seek asylum, which, as we have seen, the numbers don't change, even as we introduce these kinds of preventative or measures or, you know, put in more sticks to make it harder for people. People continue to come But the language that we put in from the beginning is informs how people see themselves and how we see them. So that language is incredibly powerful.
Lord Dubb says a more welcoming approach from government can make a world of difference.
There are some local communities that are very supportive. It's a mixed picture. And I think a bit of encouragement from the top will enable local communities to be more supportive. But there has been a hostile atmosphere as regards asylum seekers and refugees for years. And it's very difficult to expect local communities to be 100% supportive when senior politicians say these people shouldn't be here. All this stuff about the boats, you know, and inward migration. For heaven's sake, last year we had 600,000 people, of whom about 30,000 actually came as asylum seekers. Totally out of proportion. You'd think that everybody who was coming had come on a boat and this was all terrible and they're all invaders. Absolute nonsense. And we've got to get it in proportion and treat people like human beings and treat them decently and show them respect and give them the sort of opportunities that I had.
As we look forward, what can the government do to ensure refugees and asylum seekers are seen not as burdens, but as valuable contributors to society? Amos told me some of his practical ideas.
Two simple sort of cheap fixes. One is around how much we're processing people who are and their asylum claims. In the early 2010s, there was over 80% of people had their asylum claims seen within 6 months. And that's the target the government set itself. Mm-hmm. 84 or 86%, give or take. By 2023, that was 13% of people who were seen within 6 months. That's already a positive trajectory mm-hmm. because before that it was 6%. The government can very easily start processing claims faster, looking at the countries people come from. We know that if you are coming from Afghanistan at the moment, if you're coming from Sudan at the moment, if you're coming from Eritrea, for these are sort of top mm-hmm. three that come to mind, you are overwhelmingly likely to have a real claim. So your claim can be seen much quicker. You don't mm-hmm. need to spend as much time interrogating. Meanwhile, if you are coming from places that perhaps is less likely, you might want to spend more time on it so that people can have that opportunity to present themselves. So processing those claims faster gets people to the stage where they can receive real fulsome support faster. The other one is around the right to work, which is such a common sense win that the vast majority of the British public do support it. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of MPs support it. But we're still stuck in this situation, almost uniquely in the world, where an asylum seeker has no upper limit on when they are banned from working. Hmm. If you come to the UK as an asylum seeker and you haven't yet got your refugee status, you are not allowed to work. And right. you are also not even allowed to be on the benefit system. You're on a different system earning or receiving like £9 a day.
I mean, that is almost impossible to live on.
It is impossible to live on. These are people who, you know, aside from their housing, that £9 has to cover everything else.
Yeah.
Their phone data, their food, their travel. These are people who have to lean on and rely on charities and, you know, religious communities to help them. And that's not sustainable. And it's, you know, it's not the job of charities to do the job of government. So by allowing people to work outside of the shortage occupations, which is how the government currently sees
shortage occupations. Those are things that we just don't have enough of.
Right. So like, these are the things that you're allowed to work on if you are a migrant or, if, you know, trying to work out who's allowed to come in. They are being a civil engineer,
right.
a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer. It's a STEM teacher. It's a Gaelic teacher. We have a shortage of Gaelic teachers.
I'm sure there's a lot of folks coming from Afghanistan who skilled in Gaelic.
I hope so. I'd be delighted if so. There's also, you know, being a care assistant is also on that list.
Right.
But, you know, we lack HGV drivers. We lack people who can pick fruit in and vegetables for us. These are jobs that the British public has shown themselves unwilling to do and much more willing to rely on migrant labour to do. And yet we shut off an opportunity to fill up those jobs and also an opportunity to benefit from people doing those jobs.
Access to work and education is crucial for anyone to contribute to society. Taban emphasized what else is critical for refugees to rebuild their lives so they are better able to contribute to their new communities.
I think opportunities to learn the language and allowing them to work. It's one thing that's crucial. And I see it in our work that we do in Northern Iraq, Kurdistan, it's kind of very similar. You know, it's a basic human need. Everyone here and everyone listening to this what are the basic needs that we need outside of food, shelter, and security? It's the opportunity to have an education. It's the opportunity to be able to work. It's the opportunity to have access to health needs, so mental health needs, physical, medical needs, and the opportunity to be within a social community. And those things are essential to humans. They're just basic needs for humans. So how can we accommodate that and provide a platform to allow that to happen? Helping them learn English is definitely one. And then allowing them to find ways to make it easier for them to work. The moment you've got financial independence for them and their family, not only does it help them, their family and the community, but it helps the economy as well. But also I would say helping them adjust to a new environment, a new culture. And, you know, it's, we have to remember that we've left all everything that we know and love. You know, we might be fleeing persecution, we might be fleeing conflict, but we've left a home that we love. We've left family members that we love. We've left friends that we love, language, food, culture, music, all these things that kind of enrich someone we've been forced to flee from. And so those are really essential. How do we kind of accommodate that and allow them to have those experiences within their community as well? To learn about the new systems. One thing that we face here, for example, is parenting laws. Parenting laws are very, very different all around the world. And so, for example, if you come to the UK and you don't know something about a particular parenting law, you've had a lot of families separated because there's not that knowledge or understanding of what you can't do, what you can't do legally, what might have been accepted culturally in
like what?
In
what's an
country.
Example of what might have been accepted
for example,
locally that
we,
isn't
I mean,
accepted
we have
here.
A child we have a child protection program in Iraq. And we do parenting programs there. So what you can do, what you can't do with children, you're not allowed to hit children, you're not allowed to discipline, smack, you know, all these things. It might be culturally accepted in some areas, but the moment you do it here, it's not just culturally not accepted, but it's legally binding that something, there's a repercussion. If the child goes into school and the teacher finds out, the teacher will report it, social services get involved, and then a lot of families have been separated from this issue. So there's a lot of knowledge sharing that needs to be had, a lot of peace building within communities, and also exposing, you know, communities that are already here to communities that arrive. How can we share those cultural differences to be celebrated? And I think the arts and the culture is a great way to kind of do that. So more funding is also needed in that. I think that kind of covers it. But work, I'd say, is essential because it's quite an immediate one.
I asked Lord Dubs how he thought the UK's approach to refugees should change.
First thing is we need a change in attitude. Taban has talked about the attitudes. We need a change in attitude so that there's a sense coming from government that these people are not hostile, that these people should be welcomed. They've been through awful experiences, and by welcoming them, we are doing something for them, and we're doing something for the country. So, secondly, I think what we need is to help them to cope with life in this country. That's to say, we have to make the environment as welcoming as possible, both in terms of something I said earlier, ability to learn English, but also generally to acquire skills. Most of the young people that come here that I've talked to are desperate to resume their education, which they've missed out on very badly. If they're older, they are desperate to get jobs. Those are two things. If they're old, they want jobs. Older, if they're on jobs, and if they're younger, they want to get back to education. And we need to facilitate that, to give them the chance to continue with their education and then become members of our society and members of our community. I think those are the sort of things that would help. So I think, and the other thing is, I think family reunion. I do think we need to say that separating families is intolerable. It is an abuse of their rights. It's an abuse of everything. And I think what we need to do is to ensure that where their families here, that they can be joined by other members of their families, their children here, that they can be joined by parents. If their parents here, they can be joined by children. All these sort of things make such a difference. And to keep families apart is absolutely intolerable.
I would say my biggest message is that we're a great asset to the community. People with lived experience have, I'd say, a sixth sense where they've developed certain things from their experiences. And that really, when brought into the community, enriches everyone's experience. I think allowing people to really express their culture, their experiences, is an asset to every community, especially the UK. I can say that from my own lived experience. I know that the areas where I've been accepted and kind of welcomed into the community, it's where I flourished. I've been given the opportunities to be able to use the assets that I have within me to be able to help my community. So I'd say welcoming refugees with an open arm and accepting them within their lived experience and figuring out how you can work with that to enrich your community.
It's not just a job for the UK. The entire world needs to do better on this. How can we work better together?
I think that issue is one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now. Mm. It's not just migration. It's AI. It's climate. It's the rise of divisive and, you know, extremist movements. They're not just confined to the UK or any one nation. But we're seeing now, you know, opportunities for greater collaboration through technology, through global movements. You know, if these global movements that inspire hate and division can rise, so can global movements, and so do global movements that inspire collaboration, support, tolerance and celebration. There's been so many lessons for the UK and how to be more welcoming to migrants from, for example, you know, learning from the successes and failures of what's happened in Australia, where they've had offshore detaining in the way that we had with Rwanda, that they had in Australia. We've had, you know, little sort of almost nuggets of ideas where how we talk about people who come to reside and be, you know, come to seek sanctuary. In the US, sorry, they get called New Yorkers, for example. Right. Or in Scotland, they get called New Scots. Uh-huh. These are really nice things that we can learn from one another in order to create those stronger, more engaging, more exciting movements. There's a great nugget that I heard from an American podcast that said, the side that is having more fun is the side that usually wins. So I think aside from, you know, the need to sit down and really interrogate issues, we also need to learn how to create exciting and engaging movements that people want to be part of. Just